attention.
Part 4. The Sessions. 10. Introduction to the case reports. During each DMT session, I took detailed notes of every aspect of that day's events, what volunteers said and did, how they looked, sounded, and felt to me, the state of the research ward, weather and world politics, the behavior and emotional tone of others in the room with us, including the research nurse, family or friends of the volunteer, and visitors, and my own thoughts and feelings. After I got back to my office, I dictated these notes and my secretary transcribed the dictation into a word processor file. When printed, these records occupy more than 1,000 pages of single-spaced text. Upon completing a particular DMT experiment, I sent the volunteer a copy of these notes to review. I asked him or her to edit for clarity, accuracy, and completeness, as well as to add anything that may have come to mind since finishing the study. Some volunteers supplemented my records with journal entries, letters, art, and poetry related to their encounters with the spirit molecule. While most sessions involved psychedelic amounts of DMT, there also were many low-dose and placebo days. These were more relaxed and gave us an opportunity to discuss and work through earlier high-dose sessions. It was quite helpful for volunteers to do this in a less altered or even completely normal state of mind. The shockwaves elicited by a big DMT experience extended far beyond a single session, continuing to reverberate in all aspects of someone's life for days, months, or years. DMT does a lot to our consciousness, but not everything. If we can limit the number of types of experiences DMT produces, we can start focusing on a manageable number of hypotheses to help understand them. Developing coherent and reasonable groupings helps us make sense of the amazingly wide array of stories we're about to hear. Another reason to categorize these experiences is to support the hypothesis that outside-administered DMT elicits altered states of consciousness similar to those that people report during spontaneous psychedelic experiences, near-death and mystical states, and the phenomenon we call alien abduction. If drug-induced and naturally occurring conditions appear to have sufficient overlap, it supports a role for endogenous DMT in the production of these spontaneous psychedelic experiences. This would then open a wide range of possibilities for us to study, understand, and apply these findings beneficially. Three major groupings capture nearly all the various experiences within these reports. While most people's actual drug sessions partook of at least two of these types, one particular category usually predominated. These three categories are personal, invisible, and transpersonal experiences. Personal DMT experiences were limited to the volunteer's own mental and physical processes. DMT helped open avenues to his or her personal psychology and relationship to the body. Chapter 11, Feeling and Thinking, presents several examples of this type of response. Once volunteers began approaching the furthest boundaries of this category, near-death and spiritual themes began to emerge. The personal then became transpersonal. The hallmark of the invisible category is an encounter with seemingly solid and freestanding realities coexisting with this one. When these planes of existence were inhabited, contact by our research subjects with these beings made for the most disturbing and unexpected type of DMT session. I cover these bizarre stories in chapters 13 and 14. The most sought-after and highly prized sessions were the transpersonal ones. These involved near-death and spiritual mystical experiences. I describe these in chapter 15, Death and Dying, and chapter 16, Mystical States, respectively. The last chapter of case reports, Pain and Fear, discusses the negative, frightening, and potentially damaging effects of DMT on our volunteers. Here we encounter the negative aspects of all three types of experiences, personal, invisible, and transpersonal. This introduction is a good place to begin addressing how we responded to what people said and did during their DMT sessions. In Chapter 7, I described how, after administering the DMT, the research nurse and I sat quietly on either side of the person's bed. We allowed the volunteer to have his or her own experience, with no more than the barest minimum of coaching. However, we could not maintain absolutely neutral and passive stances when someone began talking about confusing or anxiety-ridden experiences. If a volunteer needed our help and support, we provided it. There is a fine line between supporting a person and telling him or her what sort of experience he or she has just undergone. After a big dose of DMT, volunteers were extraordinarily suggestible, open, and vulnerable. These factors demanded exquisite sensitivity to the interpersonal field existing in the room at the time. Reflection, support, education, advice, and interpretation are quite different from criticism, argument, persuasion, and brainwashing.